Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, this is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we bring together national speakers to talk about critical issues in electronic discovery and records management at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when people are interested in the topic regardless of where they're located, because you can always download the show when you want to listen to it. Today we're talking about working with contract attorneys or staff attorneys in a dedicated review space for electronic discovery projects. This is an exciting topic for me personally because I spent a number of years owning and operating a legal staffing company, and we staff dozens of projects, between 20 to 200 attorneys, and so I'm firsthand aware of how much more complicated this topic is than many people give it credit for. And people should give this a lot of credit because there have been a number of leading estimates that say this is 70% of the cost of a typical e-discovery project. But today we've got Matt Clark on the show with us. Matt is a partner at Riley, Carlock, and Applewhite, which is a Phoenix, Arizona-based law firm. They're an interesting firm because they've got their own review facility staffed with a dedicated team of staff attorneys and handle projects for other law firms and corporations sort of loaned out and under joint management. Matt's a member of the firm's document control group. He's also a litigator and involved in labor and employment law group for the firm. He's co-founder of the firm's document control group, where he coordinates and leads project management for all e-discovery and document review projects. Matt has spearheaded the firm's effort to respond to emerging demand in the marketplace for cost-effective, efficient, and quality-driven litigation support services. Matt's actively involved in and speaks regularly on e-discovery issues. He also acts as co-counsel and serves as coordinating e-discovery and litigation support services counsel for law firms and corporate clients. Matt, when we start these shows, I always like to ask, how did you first get interested in electronic discovery?
Carl, first, thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it. I probably, like most litigators, it was a little bit of timing and a little bit of fate. In early 2000s, I guess, we started seeing more and more incidents where people were starting to request emails and other electronic documents as part of their production requests, and we became a little bit embattled in those types of things. In late 2004 and early 2005, there were a couple of opportunities in my firm where my firm needed to be able to manage some discovery issues, and at that point we just decided that it was getting to be a complex industry, and we looked at it. We realized that we probably needed to have some people dedicated in the firm who could manage these types of projects, and I kind of drew that straw, and it's been really fun. And so about that time, a couple of my partners and I started what is our document control group now, and that's sort of how we got in.
Okay. What are the sort of pros and cons of having a dedicated review space? I mean, a lot of people are familiar with going out and hiring their own contract people and trying to manage their projects on the fly or doing it internally with the people they have. But sort of talk me through the pros and cons of having a dedicated review center space.
Yeah, I mean, the pros are probably outweigh the cons, at least in our opinion they do. There's lots of them. I mean, if you think about the magnitude of an e-discovery project and you think about all the pieces that have to be, in order for the project to come off right, all the pieces that have to be sort of shepherded through. And I'm talking about all the way back in the EDRM model from where information is born to where it's produced at the other side. But on a typical project, you know, if you can get early control over pushing out preservation holds, identifying the right custodians, eliminating redundant custodians, and get an early jump on collection processing filtering, the whole review process is going to be a lot easier. So setting an entirely dedicated group in motion has allowed us to better get control over those types of things. So the big pro is total control of projects. Obviously, a fundamental pro to having a team in place in a single space is just particular project control. If we operate a facility, it's about, for instance, about 15,000 square feet, and we have different rooms within that facility that can hold different size of projects. And the projects are set up in pods. And so you might have 10 or 15 lawyers who are working on a project together. They're all in the same room. They have all the same technology. They have all their training takes place there. The review takes place there. All their communication takes place there. So during the early part of, especially the early part of a document review where there's a big steep learning curve and policies change and you start to learn the data set more and, you know, you may decide that a type of document is no longer just issue 5 and 8, it's relevant to issue 10, etc. That type of thing is easier to manage when everybody's in the same room versus having people in different offices or different states or cities or something like that. So the big pro, that's obviously a big pro to us, is control, better consistency.
Yeah, I can remember setting these centers up and trying to get spare space in office buildings and making sure the IT all worked. And, I mean, you could do it, but I could see and you know, do it effectively. But it is one less thing to think about, you know, and everything works when you turn the switch, right?
That's exactly right. And it is hard because you could be reviewing on a specific type of platform. You need to make sure that all of the machines that you're going to use for that review can operate on that platform. I mean, in other words, are you able to open up documents on the back end behind the wall of the platform, or do you have to open them locally on your machine? So if you're spread around the country, that's a much more difficult task for your IT department to manage all that versus
Matt,
if you're just one
room. Can add a funny response from personal experience is to talk with the technology company saying, why isn't the data coming through quickly? Well, maybe the problem's on your end. It's probably a lot easier to say, we've done dozens of projects from this space and we don't have that problem. It's on your end.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and that's right. And so it just works out well. I mean, and it's great. You know, you asked about cons too. I mean, there aren't really a lot of cons, but we do sometimes get, you know, because we have clients who are on the East Coast to West Coast. So we may be in New York or L.A. with a client, and they say, well, you know, our litigation team is here. Our litigation is here, but our review is going to be in Phoenix. You know, is that right? Is that going to work? I guess a couple of responses to that. You know, I mean, we've been asked to go to different cities, and we can take our team and move them to different cities. But the reality is we kind of live in a virtual world now. And so wherever these documents are, you're going to load them up into a secure site. We're going to go in behind a firewall and look at those documents remotely anyway. So we really don't need to be in L.A. And, you know, or New York or whatever city it's in. I think the benefit of having all of your team in one place certainly outweighs the inconvenience, if it is that, of having to have, you know, an associate from your litigation firm fly to Phoenix for a few days while the project starts or something like that. So. Anyway, I think it's a good project.
Okay. The only thing that I can think of that you didn't touch upon is, you know, in this marketplace with lots of lawyers being downsized, that the pool of candidates might be a little bit different in one location as opposed to being in multiple markets. I can see pros and cons of having a dedicated team versus grabbing people that are available. But what do you say to the depth of people that are looking for work that are available for projects that are out there?
Well, Phoenix has been I'm in Phoenix. Phoenix has been a great market for us. It has historically not been a reciprocity state, so a lot of people move here with their spouse or retire here, and without taking the bar, you can't practice traditionally in courts. So those people are available to do this type of work. But it's also a pretty terrific market to move to, and we've been successful recruiting people from around the country to come out here and join our team to work with our group out here in Phoenix, and they just relocate. Phoenix is a great city. It's a big city. It's a great legal community. There's a ton of great stuff to do, so that has not really been an obstacle for us.
I actually noticed one of my former reviewers is on your list, so I'll mention that after the show. But, good reviewer, I got to say. So
we try to pick the best.
When you're in a dedicated review sort of model, do you find that having a salaried staff or contingent pay staff is the best model? And do you work with bonuses in this sitting also?
Yeah, I think that this type of industry probably lends itself to an hourly rate, and primarily because it's an ebb and flow kind of industry. You'll be extremely busy for, you know, 6 months, and then you'll slow down for a few weeks. And just by having an hourly rate allows us to better manage the expenses on a month-to-month basis. I also, the fact of the matter is, whether you put somebody on salary or hourly, if you have a steady flow of work and they have a good firm belief and that you're going to keep the work coming in and they're, you know, part of the team and are there for years, whether it's a salary or hourly, people are going to make, in fact, on hourly, people can make more money because they can work harder and work more hours, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we do an hourly rate on all of our staff attorneys and project managers on up on down. Bonuses, I can see the utility of bonuses in the industry. I think they probably have more they're probably more common in more of an agency environment where you're trying to make sure where somebody maybe is working for you on a unique project, but then they're going to look for another project when that's over. And I suspect there's probably temptations to leave projects before they're complete if something newer or bigger comes along, and that may be a difficulty for agencies, and they probably get some mileage out of using bonuses to sort of manage that. But we really haven't had that problem in our setting because it is, people are hired by us, they work here, this is where they work, and we really don't have that threat of jumping to another review project. So
those all make sense. I know the one other thing that an agency sometimes can hold over the head of a contractor is if you jump early, you're not getting placed again.
Yeah.
And there's that too. But bonuses are appreciated more, I think. This is an interesting question I'm about to ask you because I've done a couple of podcasts with Judge Facciola and Judge Grimm recently, and both were rather, they lamented the effect of all the ESI and the fact that it needs to be reviewed, you know, eyeballs on every document, and how that puts a strain on our lawyers in terms of not creating an intellectually stimulating work environment for the best and brightest, you know, the future, you know, partners. And you know, what's your reaction to that, and how do you address that concern?
Well, I guess I have lots of thoughts, so you'll have to cut me off if I go crazy on it. I mean, first, I think this is an industry that's probably best suited for litigation attorneys because it's very much litigation-based. So if you're an unemployed tax lawyer or M&A lawyer, you may not find this very interesting at all, and you may not like it very much at all. But most litigation attorneys, whether you're in a firm or wherever you are, you spend the better part of your career, certainly I did, doing document review, and you learn to be a good litigator by, you know, figuring out how to use discoverable, admissible facts. And in most instances, those discoverable, admissible facts, at least the good ones, are usually wound up in a great big pile of useless documents. So you learn to go through this drudgery of document review to get to the good stuff. So, you know, the concern that the process is not intellectually stimulating is probably well-founded, but I don't know that it's necessarily new. I suppose that, in fairness, it's probably true that this ESI boom has brought a lot more attention to this aspect of litigation. And so what was once 100 hours of work is now 2,000 hours of work. So there's certainly more focus on it and certainly more money being spent on it. And perhaps there's a flood of the wrong people, and I don't want to call them the wrong people, but people being attracted to this market that don't like it very much and don't like anything about it, you know. I mean, at least litigation people recognize that for every 15 minutes of great cross-examination, there's 15 hours of this tedious legwork and document review that goes into it. So, I mean, I've read lots of articles and heard lots of stories about, you know, lawyers, really great lawyers who write the tell-all dirty little secrets articles that get published and how they're stuffed into kind of tiny little sweatshops where they perform meaningless work for hours on end and there's no hope in sight and they feel ashamed and unappreciated and all that kind of stuff. And does that happen? I don't know. Maybe it does happen. But I don't think it has to happen. And you know, for our part, we don't run that type of operation. I think that once you get that the document review is actually a critical and important part, and it may be huge, and it may be, as you said, 70% of the e-discovery spend. It may be big, but it's not unimportant. And once you can get that message across that it's meaningful work, I think people are more receptive to doing it if it's meaningful work. So having said all that, I think that the trick is not to try to focus on our efforts on finding a way to make document review more intellectually stimulating. I think the real trick is to find ways to surround yourself with talented, smart attorneys who understand and are content with the fact that while document review is probably not the most exciting part of litigation, it's certainly extremely important to it. And, you know, I mean, for our part, I think that's how we're able to maintain staff and have some success. I think we do a good job of surrounding ourselves with those types of people. And I think, standalone review facilities that we're talking about probably spend a little more time trying to find the right people. And I think maybe the industry can learn from that.
Yeah, and I remember coming out as a lawyer in 92 before the e-discovery boom, and the statistics didn't show law to be particularly a lot of satisfaction in practicing law before e-discovery. So I think there might be some other bigger issues in nurturing lawyers and training them other than just e-discovery. So
I think that's a good point as well.
So you've talked about, you know, what some of the things that you've done that have worked for you to sort of motivate long-term document review staff. That's one of the things that I always used to struggle with. You know, how do you motivate someone over the long term in this type of role? Is there a career path here, or is this a stepping stone? Or, you know?
Yeah, well, it's a couple things. We tend to focus our recruiting efforts on people who we think are going to be satisfied longer. So, in other words, rather than trying to recruit, you know, the first, second year associate, you know, right out of law school, and jeepers, I'm going to be a great asset to your firm, we try to find people who maybe been out 10, 15, 20 years, who sort of been there and done that, and they kind of find something desirable about the flexibility and the freedom that comes with this type of work. I mean, you come in, you work 8-10 hours a day. You don't have to worry about a motion tomorrow. You don't have to worry about oral argument tomorrow. You don't have to worry about witness prep, any of that kind of stuff. You're doing the behind-the-scenes litigation support, so it's a little less stressful. The other thing is, and this may be unique to, I don't want to go on about us, but this may be unique to the DCG because we're a practice group within a law firm, but we a lot of times get more involved in the litigation process than just the first cut review. We'll end up in situations where we're doing, I mean, fundamentally our value proposition is to do the full review, which is first, second, doc coding, priv log. So you're doing the whole thing. But then, you know, we get treated a little bit more like co-counsel on these things by the corporate legal department or the litigation firm, and they'll say, well, look, we want you to, you guys have this wealth of knowledge about all these documents. You just looked at 200,000 documents. Are our theories right? Can you help us with the witness preps? Can you help with the depo preps? You know, so there's a little bit more interactive stuff that goes on. I think that tends to make it a little more exciting, a little more challenging, a little less sort of redundant, and maybe we get some relief from that. You know, in terms of career path, again, we try to find people who are content being a part of a litigation support team that helps a lot of different clients, and this is what they want to do, and they tend to stick around. And, you know, in our 5 years, we've had pretty good retention.
Well, that's all good. One of the pushbacks I'd get when I talk about, you know, you should do your review here in Pittsburgh is, well, what's the footprint look like? I mean, how big can you get? What if this is a massive project? And I know not all projects are several hundred attorney projects, but say the whale of a project comes in, are there contingent plans or arrangements that a dedicated review facility can use to either work together with other facilities or to scale out? Have you thought about that or encountered that?
Yeah, well, I guess from my experience, we occupy enough space that gives us some build-out potential. So foundationally, I think if you're a review center like what we are, the fundamental things start to fall in place. You've got the brick and mortar, you've got the IT support, you have the tables and chairs and desks and workstations and telephones and all that stuff in place. And then you build your management structure, and then you build your processes and your quality control processes, and you have a process in place for how information comes in, how reviews are performed. The foundation for all that sort of comes into place. And then adding to that becomes a lot easier. So if a client calls you and says, hey, you know, we've used you a lot of times, Usually it's 8 or 10 or 15 people. This time it's going to be 60. Looks like it's going to be a 12 to 18 month project. Can you accommodate this? It's easier many times to go out and recruit heavy and bring people in because your foundation is there and you're just adding people to it. Having said that, certainly if something comes in where someone says, you know, I need 200 reviewers tomorrow, you'd have to decide whether you have relationships in this industry with people who you would trust with your reputation to sit down next to you and say, hey, look, you want to work on this project with me. We need 100 lawyers, and this is going to be the protocol, and we have 60 of them. Do you want to contribute 40 to this cause? And we'll, you know, bring you in on that. I'm sure that those types of relationships are in this marketplace and could be sort of achieved to get through a project like that.
Okay. We talked a little earlier about and anyone that reads you know, law.com or gets their email blast hears about downsizings, although they've slowed down, thankfully. But are you seeing resumes come in from around the country, and how do you handle transient workers?
Yeah, well, like I sort of alluded to earlier, we actually look around the country quite a bit because we might have certain needs that aren't available in Phoenix. For instance, you know, we have multi-language capabilities, so you know, we're sort of accustomed to looking for Asian languages in certain markets where there seems to be a heavier presence of those types of languages in those markets. So it's not uncommon for us to reach outside of Phoenix and look at other marketplaces. One thing, though, that's true of this, the economy is tough on lawyers right now, and there's a lot of lawyers who are finding themselves available to be in this space. But that kind of gets back to the challenge that we talked about earlier about who are you going to target to be part of your team, because you might find some really talented, Harvard grad, 6-year patent associate who was, recently displaced from global law firm that might be great, but you know in the back of your mind that they're not going to stick around. And this goes back to what Judge Fatiello was saying, that these people are not intellectually stimulated, and what's that doing to this industry? So while there is an influx of a lot of talent into the marketplace, I'm not sure that all that talent fits within the specific business model that we have. So.
Yep. No, that's I've seen that firsthand. Being in a dedicated space, that gives you some perspective on doing a number of different projects. You work with different review tools, and can you talk a little bit about how different review tools can impact a project?
Yeah, we're what I call review tool agnostic, because we have different clients from different areas, we end up reviewing on a variety of different platforms. So we have a good sense for the technologies that are out there. Fundamentally, from a reviewer's standpoint, a lot of what the reviewers are doing is the same across most platforms. I mean, you look at a document, you have tagging structure, you have some links that allow you, some features that allow you to do things like link to related or near due for dupe documents or things of that nature. Some platforms have more bells and whistles than others. As it relates to bells and whistles, if you're going to have your reviewers doing things that create efficiencies, obviously you have to spend some time training them on how to use those bells and whistles in order to get the most bang out of them. From a project management standpoint, that's where a lot of, and I don't want to go into the specifics of individual platforms, but that's where you start to see differences in what individual platforms will do, and you start to see what you're getting for some of the extra money that you spend. I mean, if you're going to do an 8-gig review, you may not need to buy all the best bells and whistles that you might need for a terabyte. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You may not need to spend all the money on the clustering and concept folders and that type of technology, because you may have efficiencies that you can just build into that small review with the smaller platform. So, but at an administrative level where you want to have different rights and different types of reports, then some platforms, I guess, can be better, for lack of a better word. It probably really depends on what you want to be able to see in terms of quality control, tracking, speeds, accuracy, errors, And again, you probably have to judge how long will the project last, how much data are you going to be filtering, how much you're going to be processing, how much you're going to be reviewing. Bandwidth is another thing that you have to probably make some inquiries about. I can think of a platform, for instance, that every night at about 6 o'clock, the thing goes slow. So all of our numbers drop at slow. Our production drop at 6. Our production goes down. Docs per hour go down. So, you know, depending on what platform you're using, I guess you make decisions about when dinner time is or something like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, we talked a little bit about project managing across pods, et cetera, in a single space. And project management is something that I love about eDiscovery because it's such a it's often said, but in my experience, there's still so much work to be done in the area to get really all the parts working together. What metrics do you find, you know, from a project management perspective helpful to manage a review team?
Yeah, and again, there's a combination of metrics that you can sort of monitor on a existing project versus you know, historical projects, and then there are different reports that we rely on. So, for instance, I mean, we rely heavily on docs per hour. I know that's the most unfair thing to do, because people will come to you and say, "Well, look, how many documents can you review per hour?" Well, I don't know. What is it? You know, I mean, is it a patent infringement lawsuit where 80% of the custodians are engineers who, and all their documents are, you know, 18 to 25 pages, or is it, you know, 80% administrative people and most of the documents are 4-sentence emails? So it's hard to predict. But docs per hour is something that we always track, just because it's, I guess, this barometer that we want to use. There are some key things that you can do. For instance, from a quality control standpoint, you can look at, you know, as an example, maybe Matt Clark and you know, David Sands are assigned one of the custodians, and the custodian is an accountant. So from a project management standpoint, we like to track how are Matt and David tagging that same accountant's documents. If Matt tags 90% non-responsive and reviews 100 docs per hour, and David tags 90% responsive and does 62 docs an hour, that's sending a flag that there may be a problem. We may be seeing things differently. We may be making mistakes. There may be something going on. So, you know, a lot of the programs that have these types of reporting capabilities are a huge help from a quality control standpoint. And similarly, you can run reports on how many documents in the set are coded not responsive but have tags, an issue tag, in other words. How many are coded for redaction but don't have redaction? How many are coded not responsive but privileged? How many are coded hot but have no issue tags? So there's all kinds of reporting capabilities that you can do in conjunction with a lot of metrics that you can do to help projects just become more efficient, higher quality, better run. I think it's a project management thing. And I think your observation about project management being the big lacking element in this industry is probably true. Clearly, law firms aren't good at project managing things. Lawyers aren't designed to project manage things. But this is an industry that clearly needs project management from every level, from the collection through processing, filtering, review, production. All of it needs project management, and we work very hard to try to integrate good project management principles into every project that we tackle, right? So,
well, do you find that you have a seat at the table with the other stakeholders in a project, the tech vendor, the law firm, the trial lawyer, not the law firm necessarily because you're a law firm too, but the trial lawyers,
right,
the corporate client, the people doing the collection work, maybe the forensics people?
We always ask for a seat at the table.
I never got a seat at the table, by the way. I got to tell you, but this is up to 2004. So,
but times are changing, and here's where we always get a seat at the table. When we're brought in by, for instance, and again, this is unique maybe to us, but we're e-discovery counsel for firms, so for corporations. So if a corporation brings us in and they get a complaint, they send their complaint to their litigation counsel and a complaint to us. they're going to say to us, you need to be involved in all aspects of this project management. I understand that there's going to be, we're going to self-collect, but we are going to use this vendor to provide the filtering, processing, hosting. We're going to use you to review, and that vendor is going to produce, but we want you to be the project manager of the project. So in that context, you know, we have a seat at the table, and we generally report to the litigation counsel, which I think is the right thing, unless we're brought in completely behind the scenes by the corporate client, which there seems to be more of that. In other words, the corporate clients say, we're going to manage e-discovery in-house from now on, and we're going to treat it as an outsource. And then they hire somebody like myself or some other firm similar to ours, and they say, you know, we're going to get back to the days where we give, you know, the banker's boxes of responsive data to our litigation counsel and then let them do what they have to with that. But we want to get away from telling our litigation counsel, here are 26 custodians, 495 gigs of data, do something with it. Because that may or may not be fair to the litigation counsel, but it's certainly an expensive way to do it. So in those situations, we certainly have a seat at the table because we're working directly with the corporate counsel, and we do all that independent of the litigation counsel, other than litigation counsel obviously wants to have a say in who the custodians are, what the keywords are, and that type of thing, if that makes sense.
That's, you know, been, to jump into the hottest issue in staffing e-discovery, that's always been my biggest concern with offshoring. It has nothing to do with the ethics of it. It has more to do with there's still so many issues to figure out in working together. And to have someone offshore, is someone easy to blame, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and there's usually plenty of blame to go around. But I think there are some benefits to trying to do this onshore with the model that you've described, because you do have a chance to help set the structure and the strategy.
Yeah, clearly. And I think that's important. And more it's happening. That's not to say that sometimes we don't get a call and they say, you know, next Monday there's going to be 235,000 documents that we need reviewed. And that's a hard situation to get thrown into because you don't know where they are, how they got there. You don't know what exception reports exist along the way. It's more complicated. And
everyone's freaking out.
Yeah, and they always are. And also, it's easy in that situation for everyone to point the finger at someone else. Well, they were supposed to get the 300 gigs up in 24 hours. Well, they said they could do it. And they said, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But if you have, you know, what I say to corporate clients or the litigation firms, however we get brought in, I say, look, right off the bat, let's have a meeting with litigation counsel to make sure we understand who the custodians are and what the issues are and get them thinking about filters. Let's get the collection vendor if there's going to be one, the processing vendor if there's going to be one, and the review team, all a representative from each of those in place right away. Let's create a hierarchical sort of order. It doesn't matter who's ultimately in charge, as long as we have a reporting mechanism and we're all on the same page. And then those projects just seem to be seamless, you know.
Well, it's I mean the more everyone has a seat at the table and you got a structure to talk about issues, the better chance you're going to do these things right. We did a podcast with Brett Burney on this, which felt a lot like this one because I had a lot of experience in the area, and I think. You know, I've enjoyed doing the show with you because I just think that this is a topic that people need to be including in their set of issues. Look forward to doing some more shows with you at some point. And I've got a review center in Cleveland, so we can talk about East Coast, West Coast for when the whale comes in. How about that?
That'll be great. And that was my old stomping ground for a while, so I'd be happy to get back to Cleveland.
Okay, great.
Hey, Carl, thanks for having me on the show. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks again. And I'd like to let everyone know that for a complete list of shows, they can visit www.esibytes.com. Remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn tips about electronic discovery and records management before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman from Jurnov. Thanks again, everyone, and have a nice day.